For the New Books Network, this is New Books and Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Keith Simmons. Arguably, one of the most dynamic politicians of the 21st century was Hugo Chavez. Despite being in power for over a decade, however, few Venezuelans can agree on exactly what type of legacy Chavez left behind. And yet, despite having international recognition, few in the international community can come to a similar consensus. Rory Carroll, a journalist with The Guardian, has written the book Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. Rory joins us now for an interview on his book. Rory, welcome to the show.
Hey, Keith. Thank you for the invitation.
I was wondering if you could start off by perhaps giving us a little bit about your background in terms of where you went to school and how you came to be a journalist.
I was born in Dublin, Ireland, and I went to school in Blackrock College, a rugby-playing middle-class school, which I loved. It was missionary priests who ran it, and they were full of stories of Africa and Asia, places where they had been missionaries, which fascinated me. I didn't want to be a priest, but it did give me a desire to visit those places. And also my father, he was a journalist with the Irish Times and RTE, the Irish broadcaster. So that inculcated a sense of storytelling in me. And I did my bachelor's degree in Dublin. And after that, I did a journalism course for a year and then got a job at a newspaper in Belfast, where I spent my first 2 years in journalism there in my early 20s. And that was the start of my career, and I've been doing it now for 20 years.
Fantastic. And it seems as though with your work as a journalist, and particularly when you came to work for The Guardian, one of the things that you talk about in the book is how you came to write this story about Hugo Chavez. I was wondering if you could perhaps recount some of that for our listeners.
Sure. I'll give you a bit of background because this was my first and so far only book. And I had thought about doing books before. I've been with The Guardian for almost like 19 years now. And they posted me all over the world. I was in Rome covering the Mediterranean for 3 years. I've been covering Silvio Berlusconi, the Pope, the Mafia, the end of the Balkan Wars. And then I was in Africa for 4 years. And also I was in Iraq, in Baghdad, for a year. And these places were all fascinating. I loved covering them. I mean, they were challenging. But I never had, none of them ever gave me the desire to write a book, in the sense that I just felt that there was no particular story that grabbed me enough as for something that would merit me investing a good portion of my life in doing a book. And also might speak to the fact that as a journalist, my background is more writing a 1,000 or 1,500 word story. It was kind of quite long by my standards. So the idea of doing an entire book was quite daunting. But after The Guardian moved me to Venezuela, and that was in 2006, I quickly became fascinated by Hugo Chavez and what was happening in Venezuela. I had a ringside seat to the revolution. Although I did a lot of traveling around Latin America, I would always come back to Caracas, which was my home actually for 6 years, from 2006 until 2012. And I mean, Chavez is just such an unusual character, a larger than life character. And what was unfolding in Venezuela was just so again unusual. It was just so strange. And so that in itself gave me just a real drive to and a lot of curiosity to try to understand the dynamics of what was happening. But also I became very frustrated when I would travel, when I would leave. Well, I became frustrated about the misperceptions, the mythology and the propaganda for and against Hugo Chavez that kind of contaminated the truth about who he was and what he was doing. And this kind of this is partly because of polarization in Venezuela. For example, people would usually either adore the guy and revere him, or they would demonize him and say this guy is like some sort of Stalinist baby eater. And that polarization was often reflected abroad. When I would travel, I would go home to Dublin, or I'd go and visit friends in Asia or in the United States. And invariably, people go, "Oh, you live in Venezuela. What? So, what's Chavez like?" And really, often they didn't really want to hear what I had to say. It was because more people always had an opinion about Chavez, and it was usually one of two options. One is that he was a heroic, romantic figure, fighting for the poor, and standing up to George Bush, and forging a bold, new, innovative model of governance, and that this guy was a hero. Version two was the sort of thing you would see on Fox News, which was that here was a communist, or certainly a socialist demagogue who was in cahoots with Iran, perhaps with Hezbollah, who was jailing, murdering people, and so forth. And he was just like a bloodthirsty tyrant. And both of those caricatures were so far off the mark. I mean, each had a kind of had some facts to them, but they both really missed the essence of who he was. And that became very frustrating to me, because I thought, you know, why is it that people don't get it? They have to choose one of these two binary options. And that really is not desire to try to show a more nuanced portrait of Chavez. That's what gave me the impulse to write the book.
Interesting. And as you were writing the book, it seems like you tapped into a very public and I think arguably a very complex resource in order to get a better picture of Chavez. And it was to watch broadcasts of his show, Hello President. And so I'm wondering if you could perhaps talk about what that show was and sort of how you came about to use it as a source for your book.
And Chavez turned Venezuela into a version of the Truman Show, but inverted, in that he was on TV all the time, or felt like he was on TV all the time. He would pop up certainly almost daily on the airwaves, and he could speak for hours at a time. And he could be at anything. It could be he would talk, he'd turn up at a farm and he'd be driving a tractor, or he'd be in the palace, Miraflores Palace in Caracas, hosting a state visit of some dignitary, or he would be reviewing a military parade, or, you know, something. And he was always just turning up, and he was such a showman, and he was such a talented and skillful communicator. And his ability to, you know, to keep the limelight on himself meant that he kind of sucked up all the oxygen. And he was really a master of television. He would not only be a performer, but he had this weekly Sunday show called Allo Presidente, or Hello President. And this became an institution in itself, and almost it was his form of, it was like rule by television. And he would, it would move location each Sunday, and it would start at 11 o'clock, and you never quite knew where he was going to pop up. He could be in the palace, or he could be hosting it often from an outdoors venue, for example, a city plaza, or a new government-run cooperative, or anywhere. And he would have guests on the show, and he would have a live audience there of supporters. He would do cutaways via satellite to a government program somewhere else in Venezuela. And he would be hosting this. He would also be his own director. He would also be actually literally directing the cameraman during the show. And this was largely unscripted. There was no, he was not reading anything. He would just be improvising most of the time. And these shows could go on for hours and hours and hours, up to 8 hours. And it would set the agenda for the following week, and he would use the show to appoint new ministers, also to fire ministers that he felt were not performing. He'd use the show to fire broadsides or insults against his enemies, notably George Bush. And he had a whole range of choice insults about Bush. You'd call him like a drunken cowboy, a pendejo, which you could translate as sort of an asshole. He called him somebody who's more dangerous than a monkey with a razor blade, and so forth. And he was very colorful about these things. And it was kind of quite so basically knowing what he was up to, it was often simply a matter of turning on the TV. And there he would be live talking about what he was up to, saying he was talking about his plans, his dreams. For example, to build artificial islands in the Caribbean, to forge a nuclear pact with Russia, to rename the country, to rename the currency, to change the country's flag, to change the country's time zone. And he would do this all live on air, and ministers would be obliged to almost enact immediately his pronouncements. He would also mobilize troops to the border during the times of tension with Colombia. And so it was a lot of news in this show. And there's nowhere else. I've never seen anything else quite like this as a form of governance. Now, of course, there's a lot of real performance to this because, I mean, although it appeared all improvised and spontaneous, I mean, Chavez clearly was quite a shrewd planner, and he was able to use the show to basically, again, to keep the limelight on himself, and often as a way to maybe to set the agenda and to also divert people's attentions away from problems in the country and steer the conversation and narrative of his government into areas that he wanted people to talk about. So for me, I would make sure to watch the show as often as I could. And in fact, I ended up on the show myself as a guest at one time.
Really? How did you wind up on the show as a guest? That sounds like a very fascinating moment to be near Chavez.
I lobbied the government communications and information ministry. I said, "Hey, this show, I'd love to be, you know, to be, you know, to sit in on one broadcast to do like a behind the scenes story for The Guardian about what, you know, what it felt like, you know, to do the show." So eventually, after much hesitation, they said okay. So one Sunday, I was told to be at the airport very early. It was about like 5:30 a.m. And myself and a Chinese journalist, who was also allowed on the show, were taken in a government jet to a place in eastern Venezuela, a very rural coastal area, which is very, very hot. Then we were taken in helicopters, military helicopters, to a remote village. And from there, we were taken in a convoy to this little fishing hamlet, which is where Chavez was doing the show that day. And I was seated in the audience, mostly people wearing red T-shirts. And we were all sitting literally on the beach under these kind of plastic chairs with a tent. And Chavez at a desk, with all the cameras on him, and the cameras rolling, and it was a live broadcast. And so I was seated among all these red T-shirted officials, mayors, functionaries, supporters, ready to, you know, to watch the show. And it was, I think that particular day, it lasted 6 hours. And although to me it felt eternal at one point, because Chavez picked me out from the audience early on and said, "We have here a journalist from The Guardian, Rory Carroll. Welcome, Rory. What is your question? What is your question for us?" And so I actually hadn't anticipated that he was going to invite me to ask a question. So I did. I said, "Well, there's a referendum campaign on at that time, in which he wanted to abolish presidential term limits." And his critics were saying that this was very worrisome because this was another step towards authoritarianism. And so I asked him about this, about whether, you know, this concern that this would be another step towards authoritarianism. And he really let me have it. The question just kind of landed with a thump on his desk, and he you could see from his facial expression, he didn't like it. And he then proceeded to spend the next, to me it felt like hours, but I think in reality it was more like 15, 20 minutes, assailing me as a representative of colonial Europe and of all the vices of the old world, of vices of cynicism, hypocrisy. And then he went into lots of riffs, historical riffs about the Royal Navy, about Queen Elizabeth, about European genocide in Africa, and various other sins committed by Europe, and all the time using me as a rhetorical punchbag. And this went on, and I mean, eventually then he invited me to set to, he said, he asked me, what do I think about this, how to respond to this broadside. So the microphone was passed back down to me, and I said, well, you know, I'm actually not British, I'm Irish, and I'm Republican to boot. I don't believe in monarchy as a good system of government. So therefore, my views on monarchy, I'm not going to defend the monarchy, let alone Queen Elizabeth. And I said, no importa what I think about these issues, like no importa, like it doesn't matter. And he then kind of squinted at me and repeated my words back to me, no importa. And he said, yeah, no importa. And I said, yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter what I think. But he turned those words against me and he said, it doesn't matter. Well, Rory, you know, the genocide in Africa matters to us. The dignity of our people matters to us, and so forth, suggesting that I had kind of contradicted this, which I hadn't. But it was just a verbal debating trick to, you know, to turn the tables on me. And so then proceeded to pour another bucket of rhetorical excrement over my head and so forth. And so the show went on. What was interesting was eventually he actually did answer my question about 2 or 3 hours later into the show. And his answer to my question was actually really interesting and I think very sincere. He said the reason they had to abolish term limits and basically give him the opportunity of being perpetually reelected in power for life was that the revolution was like a painting and he was the artist and the painting was unfinished and therefore he as the artist could not in good conscience pass the brush to somebody else because only the artist can see the vision of what the painting should be when it's finished and therefore he had to finish the painting. And I think because he was actually an amateur painter himself and I think that's really how he saw things. And so, I mean, painful as it was for me to elicit that response in that way, but it did basically shed light on how he viewed his role in Venezuela and his role in history, really. So that was my one and only cameo on Allo Presidente.
And it sort of sounds like it's a cameo that you wouldn't necessarily want to repeat again in the future, I imagine.
No, I wouldn't rush to repeat that. and it was funny because I became like for a few days and weeks after that, I became like a minor celebrity in Venezuela. And since the people would stop me in the street and go, are you the guy? You're the guy who's on the team. And what was funny was that the people who despised Chavez said, their interpretation appeared to be that I really stuck it to the man. I was bold and I stood up to him and he freaked out. Whereas Chavez's supporters saw it as another way. They felt that, no, this was more like an honest exchange and might be robust, but it was all cool and everything was fine. And Chavez gave a very compelling answer to my answer and so forth. And, that's just a little illustration of how Chavez was able to that he elicited such strong, visceral, and such contrasting responses in people that they could see the same thing and yet draw completely different conclusions. And that also applied, of course, to people watching Venezuela from afar in the United States, Europe, elsewhere. They would look at Venezuela and either see system of government that was enlightened and progressive and uplifting the poor, or they would see a system that was authoritarian, thuggish, dictatorial, communist, but looking at the same country. So there's almost a sense of magical realism there that, you know, people, you know, of mirages and which enables people to project their own values and fantasies onto this canvas that was Hugo Chavez's Venezuela.
And I think part of what's crucial in order to understand that aspect of Hugo Chavez, not only in the sense of him being polarizing, but when you start talking about his background, where he grew up, the sort of things that he enjoyed, I wonder if you could perhaps tell us a little bit about those details, because I think it's certainly crucial to keep these things in mind when you're trying to ultimately assess the type of individual that Chavez was.
He was born in a very rural area of Barinas State, very kind of rural agricultural backwater. And he had five brothers. He was largely raised by his grandmother, actually, rather than his parents, which was interesting. And he was a great baseballer. I mean, he was actually quite talented as a kid as baseball. So his dream as a teenager was to play in the major leagues. And so he, for that reason, he joined the military, which is a good option for a kid from you know, these kind of poor background. Was you join the military, you get an education. And in his case, he hoped that he would become, he could then join the military, would then train him for sports, and he could become, pursue his dream. But somewhere along the line, he discovered that he loved the military. He loved soldiering. He loved uniforms. He loved the marching, the parades, the camaraderie, the sense of hierarchy. And it just really suited him. And so he spent almost his entire life, his entire adult life before politics in the military. And he, even after he left the military, he would always kind of call himself a soldier. And that was very much his mindset. That's where he was educated, and that's where he matured into an adult. And I think that was very instructive into the politician he became, because he was often very, he acted in a military sense that he was the commander, he'd be passing down orders, and that his minions and colleagues would do what he ordered. This was partly following the culture of the caudillos in Latin America, and certainly on the military background. But it was also in the military where, ironically, although he pledged loyalty to the government, and at that time Venezuela in the 70s and 80s had democratic government. I mean, Venezuela was a liberal democracy, albeit quite a dysfunctional one. There was a lot of corruption, and there was a certain degree of decay in some of the democratic institutions. So and also there's a lot of inequality in the country. Now, Venezuela is a petrostate, and that is probably the single most important fact about Venezuela, and one which is often overlooked by people looking from afar. It's a petrostate, and that affects its economy. It affects how people view their own country. And so when there's poverty, and there was a lot of poverty, and still is, people would feel that it's not just because the country isn't working well, it's because somebody's stealing the money, because there's a lot of petrodollars, but if I'm poor, therefore it's because somebody's stealing the petrodollars. And I think certainly that's how Chavez looked at it. And so he led a coup against the government in 1992. And until then, he was unknown. He was a lieutenant colonel, and he specialized in communications and armor, which, again, is quite telling in terms of his personality. This is a guy who had the gift of the gab, and he liked tanks. So right there, these two facets of his personality. The coup was a military fiasco. It caused a lot of explosions in Caracas, but it collapsed very quickly. But it turned him into a media star. I mean, out of this, the ashes of this defeat, he went on television to order his troops to surrender. And he used just basically a soundbite but he appeared to a startled nation, introducing himself and saying that their objectives had not been achieved for now, but that they basically hinting that they would be back. And this made him a star. People, because the government is so unpopular, that they thought this guy is very dashing. He had a beret. He's very articulate. And so, although he went to jail for the coup, he emerged from jail a few years later. He was released early, and he was a politician at that point. And then he was able to assemble a coalition of grassroots movements, of left-wing groups, progressive groups, old-style communists, environmentalists, a very eclectic coalition. And he became the head of this coalition. He then roared to an election victory in 1998. And this was because oil prices had collapsed and Venezuela was in its economy was on its knees. People were desperate and they were angry. And so they voted for Chavez as the outsider, as he was a guy who's going to come in into and clean up or reinvent a broken system. And that was the mandate he was given when he was elected.
And I think given this background that you just talked about with Chavez, that dives into his philosophy and sort of his vision for the revolution, it sounds as though that's really the beginning stages of when people weren't really sure what to make of Chavez, because he didn't necessarily try to go in and immediately shake over the power structure. He tried to keep a lot of things in place initially, but some of that gradually starts to change, and he seems to sort of push out his old power coalition. So I wonder if you could perhaps tell us what you see as sort of the crucial turning point when Chavez ultimately shifts perhaps one way or the other, or if that never happened at all.
Now, there was a definite shift. The early Chavez in his first few years of power was actually quite cautious, quite moderate in his policies. He'd retained the previous outgoing finance minister. He insisted that he was no socialist. And in fact, he professed to be in favor of a Blair type third way between socialism and capitalism. And, you know, he was fiscally prudent and so forth. So what was not cautious was his rhetoric. It was always quite strident. I mean, even in the early time, he'd be very insulting and often to the point of vulgarity about his opponents. And that was just his style. But he was quite cautious economically. Until then, in 2002, he'd been in power over 3 years by then. The opposition was very radical. They hated him, and they felt that he was a usurper, that he was dangerous, and they staged a coup, and they briefly overthrew him. This was a collection of the Venezuelan military and the old elites, and it was given tacit backing from George Bush's White House. Now, the coup briefly ousted Chavez, but it then swiftly unraveled, and he stormed back to power stronger than ever. And he, after that, I think that was one tipping point. And I think because it gave him such a fright that he realized just how high the stakes were, and that some of his opponents were certainly not going to play by democratic rules. So that was that's radicalized him. And then soon after that, he started using the word socialist, saying, well, from 2005, I think he outed himself as a socialist. And he forged an ever closer alliance with Fidel Castro, which meant bringing in lots of Cuban doctors and nurses in a very innovative program to bring health clinics right into the barrios, into the heart of the slums. Less happily, it also meant bringing in lots of Cuban intelligence agents and military planners as well. And they gradually took over large chunks of the Venezuelan government. And some people would say they actually became the puppeteers, in the sense that Chavez often trusted the Cubans more than he trusted some of his own Venezuelan officials. And for me, I think a real turning point was around 2007, when he'd won another term, he'd won re-election 2006 by a very big landslide. And everything seemed to be going his way. Oil prices had exploded, so state coffers were swamped with petrodollars. I mean, so much money. It was like a historic bonanza, raining petrodollars on Venezuela. George Bush and the Iraq adventure was becoming a disaster for the United States. And so Chavez had a sitting duck in terms of a widely despised foe. So he became a champion or a spokesperson for people who could not really abide George Bush. And I think it all went a bit to his head, because you could see then a lot of mistakes, you know, one mistake piled onto another in terms of economically and especially economically. I'll give you some examples. They started persecuting private landowners. The government would encourage people to seize the land. People would kind of march into and occupy hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland, and the government would then, in place of what had been a private farmer, they would then spend a lot of money setting up these socialist cooperatives. And I visited a lot of them, and the idea in some ways that was actually quite an attractive idea, but the execution was abominable. There was complete mismanagement. Funds were wasted. People weren't trained properly. And it became, and you could see the consequences in food production. Food production plummeted. You could see then there was shortages in the stores. And so instead of acknowledging the error of this policy, Chavez would then try to tackle the symptoms. He said, well, if there's shortages, this is because supermarkets are hoarding food. So we're still going to start arresting supermarket managers. Or if prices are rising, it's not because it's a shortage caused by our policies. It's because capitalist vampires are trying to sabotage the revolution. So, for example, the army would go and arrest butchers and haul them off to military barracks. And these sort of mistakes were piling up. And the same thing would happen with the state's energy infrastructure, which they would not invest properly in electricity or power plants. And so they began to decay and to run down. So blackouts became quite common, which Chavez would then blame on the CIA. Or at one point, I think they also blamed possums for eating the cables and causing blackouts. And this went on. And then he would say, oh, the currency, because the government's printing presses were going into overdrive and, of course, more inflation, Chavez's solution was to rename the currency and to shave three zeros off it and to rename it the strong currency, which, of course, is just, it did nothing to solve the problems. And I could go on, but there was a whole series of these issues, problems, which one began to accumulate over the years. Now, in the short term, Chavez was able to paper over these problems with petrodollars, because he had always, there was so much money. The government controls most of the oil fields, and so they could use that money to subsidize things, for example, by giving people free gasoline, or certainly the cheapest gasoline in the world. You can fill a 4x4, an SUV tank there for about, I think now it's probably down to like 5 cents. It used to be a bit more expensive, like maybe, you know, 40 cents. Electricity became almost free, but at the expense of not investing in the electricity infrastructure. So the economy became trapped in this populist labyrinth, whereby people were grateful for the government for giving them free gasoline or doubling and then tripling the state payroll, so also giving them jobs. And yet at the same time, the government's policies were killing the private sector and the productive sector of the economy. So what was happening was the economy was being hollowed out from the inside. And parallel to this, Chavez was also hollowing out democratic institutions. He was stacking all of the courts with political appointees, and so the courts were consistently giving very politicized decisions. Same thing with the electoral authorities. He also expanded the state media apparatus, so that the government, initially he had one TV channel, and then in the end, I think he had about eight. And so it became a cult of personality, began to flower around the same time as the wheels were coming off the economy. And this was the pattern that really continued right up until his death in 2013.
And it seems like one of the other fascinating stories about Chavez, and particularly when you mention his death, is that it seemed as though it was sort of difficult for him to identify a successor initially. I mean, he struggled for a number of years, I believed, with cancer, and sometimes had to go and try to receive treatments in places like Cuba and other locations. But ultimately, Chavez is able to produce a successor for his revolution, Nicolas Maduro, who is now the current president of Venezuela. And Maduro certainly has, I think, an interesting story in his own right. But I wonder if you would mind perhaps providing us an assessment of how you think Maduro has perhaps tried to carry on Chavez's legacy up to this point.
Yes, Maduro is quite an interesting character. And physically, he's quite imposing. Very tall guy, very broadly built, very thick, kind of bushy mustache. And he was originally a bus driver in the Caracas kind of metro bus system. And he rose up the union ranks. I was told that early on in his career, he got a doctor's certificate saying that he was sick, which then enabled him to work full time in the union while still taking a bus driver's salary. And and that's where his background came. And Chavez appointed him as a foreign minister, which initially a lot of diplomats I knew were kind of quite puzzled by this, because Maduro really is not well educated. He doesn't speak any languages. And so they were kind of, well, why have this guy as your foreign minister? But he actually kept the post for 6-7 years, which in the revolving door policy of Chavez's cabinet, that was a very long time. And he kept it because he was just very loyal to Chavez. He appeared to never have any of his own ideas. He just did what Chavez wanted. And Chavez, of course, liked that. And it also helped Maduro's case with Chavez that he was very close to the Cubans. He had would spend a lot of time in Havana, because the alliance with the Castros is the single most important alliance that Venezuela had. And so I think Chavez just really trusted him. He thought that this guy wasn't a threat. He wasn't one of those people who's likely to try to destabilize Chavez. And so when Chavez became quite sick with cancer, although he denied it up until the very end that he was going to die, he always insisted that this cancer was not terminal, and in fact that a miracle from God had cured him. But this was a deceit really perpetrated on Venezuelans, because it was terminal. And Chavez prepared the way by appointing Maduro as his vice president several months before he died. And this was an indication that he, Chavez, viewed Maduro as the best chance that the revolution could, that all of the different factions, rival factions within the government and the revolution would be, their best chance of keeping them together was with Maduro at the helm. And in this, he proved to be correct. Maduro was able to, once he became president, he kept the loyalty of the military. He had the Cubans certainly backing him. He also had the so-called oligarchs, which is the kind of the multimillionaires and billionaires who've minted fortunes by playing arbitrage and within the strange economy. All these wealthy benefactors also supported Maduro. And so he has, and since he took over, he's basically kept Chavez's policies intact. He's basically done no changes, no really meaningful change to any of the economic policies. What he has done politically is he's become actually even harder than Chavez in terms of jailing certain political opponents and using intimidation tactics against street protesters. The reason he's had to do this is because the economy is now completely unraveling. And this is directly a function of all of the policies that Chavez had put in place. And often what people miss when they think of Hugo Chavez, it's they think, oh, was he a dictator or was he a Democrat? Well, he was a hybrid. He was an elected authoritarian. But the most important thing about him is that he was a completely incompetent manager. He drove the economy into the ground. And that's why we've seen Venezuela, certainly in the past 18 months, with inflation now apparently in triple digits, more than 100%, if you believe the unofficial accounts, shortages of basic goods, toilet paper, sanitary pads, cooking oil, spare parts for cars, you name it, there's chronic shortages. The institutions, like hospitals, are out of medicines. The police forces are often moonlight themselves as gangsters. It's a very sad, tragic legacy. And Maduro has proved completely unable to change gears, because these problems that Venezuela is now enduring are functions of what Chavez himself had of all these distortions and strange populist policies that he entrenched over the years. And Maduro, because he's not as strong as Chavez, in a sense, has not been able to take pragmatic, painful but pragmatic steps to rein in some of the more wilder distortions. And so instead, he's hunkered down by trying to be even more Chavez than Chavez. By this, he's still picking as many fights with the United States as he can, even though Washington is now has making a big detente with Cuba. He's also, as I mentioned, he's become more authoritarian than Chavez was. And this just shows, I think, two things about him. One is that he lacks the kind of the imagination and also the pragmatic streak that Chavez had, because I think Chavez would have taken certain steps to alleviate some of the distortions, to try to put the economy back in an even keel. But Maduro just has been paralyzed. And the second reason for this is that he feels threatened and undermined on all sides. His popularity ratings have plunged. They're now into the 20s. A lot of people within Chavismo think he's not up to the job. And so he feels that, you know, he's not in a position where he can make painful adjustments, because by doing so, it would further alienate some of his constituencies who already don't like him. So what we're seeing is a weak ruler who feels shackled to these policies that are driving the country over the edge. I mean, and Venezuela really is falling into the abyss, and Maduro is completely unable to arrest the fall. I mean, I'll just give you one personal example. My wife is Venezuelan, and I drove her to the airport in Los Angeles this morning, and she's going to Caracas tonight to visit her relatives. And her suitcases were packed with toilet roll, tampons, detergent, cooking oil, and other essentials like that for her family. And her family is middle class. And Venezuela is a petrostate that still has lots of money. And yet, you know, those are the things that she now needs to bring to her family so that they can live. And that's the Venezuela that Maduro is presiding over. And unfortunately, I see no signs or very few signs for optimism or any signs that things are going to get better.
And as you mentioned, I think certainly with what's going on between the United States and Cuba, and perhaps broader geopolitical events, that would certainly complicate Maduro's position. And as you mentioned, it remains to be seen, I think, as to whether or not he'd be able to hold on to power. Well, Rory, we've certainly taken up a lot of your time today, but before we go, I was wondering if you could perhaps tell our listeners about a current project you may be working on, whether it's a book or something else of that nature.
I've been looking for a book idea since I've been in the US. I've been here 3 years now, and I've plunged into some projects and then discarded them. My latest, it's not a book project, but next week I'll be going to St. George, a little town in Utah, which is where it's downwind from where the U.S. used to test nuclear bombs in the 1950s and 1960s. It's also the site where John Wayne filmed one of his worst films ever. It's called The Conqueror, where he played Genghis Khan, a dreadful turkey. Anyway, from that film, subsequently, more than half of the cast and crew got cancer, and John Wayne died from it, as did his leading lady, and as did a director. Now, some people in Hollywood think that it was the radiation caused by the nuclear testing that gave some of these people cancer. So certainly, the people in St. George, they have been getting compensation from the government because it's clear that actually some of the cancers there were caused by atomic testing. So it's going to be the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of this film soon. And so I'm going to take a trip to St. George to find people who are involved in the film and also people who are there talking about survivors from cancer and some of the history of the atomic testing in the area. So it's kind of a historic story, but with certain kind of modern resonance. And I think it'd be more like a magazine story for The Guardian. So that's what's on my agenda for the next few days.
It certainly sounds like a fascinating project, and we absolutely wish you well with that endeavor. Rory Carroll is a correspondent with The Guardian, whose book, Comandante, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, is available in paperback in bookstores around the world. Rory, thanks again for your time.
Okay, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Keith.
Once again, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to join us today on Latin American Studies. For the New Books Network, I'm Keith Simmons. Until next time.